This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 11th of February 2016 on Monocle 24.
Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. Today I'm joined in the studio by Sarah Shaffy, online editor for The Bookseller, for this week's literary discussion. On the bookshelf today, we have Sunil Yapa's take on the 1999 World Trade Organization protests in his debut novel, Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist. Then there's the tale of a family who form a relationship with a pod of whales in Australian writer Shirley Barrett's Rush O. And finally, we'll be leafing through The Ballroom by Anna Hope, which explores the love story between two asylum patients brought together during a dance one evening. That's all to come on today's edition of the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Sarah. Your first pick for today is a debut novel by American Sri Lankan writer Sunil Yapa. Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist is set during the anti-globalization protests in Seattle that took place at the World Trade Organization conference in 1999. The protest was at least 40,000 strong, but this story focuses on the lives of seven fictional characters whose lives are changed in that one afternoon. Sarah, tell us a bit about these seven characters.
Yeah, so we meet a variety of people over the course of the book. Our focus is really Victor, a young man who we discover pretty early on, his dad is the chief of police in Seattle, but the two haven't seen each other in a number of years since tragedy struck the family. So we begin with Victor and then we move on through to finding out what the police are doing, how they're dealing with the protesters. We meet a number of protesters and a number of other police officers as well, who behave in interesting ways, shall we say, for now. And we also meet a delegate at the World Trade Organization protests as well. Well, he's there to attend the conference and to get a good deal for his country, but obviously can't make it in because there are 40,000 protesters, at least, in the way.
Right. I mean, so we obviously have this cast of characters. How successfully are the stories kind of weaved together, I guess?
Absolutely brilliantly. We're physically, some of the characters are apart. So we have Victor and we have a couple of other protesters, a bit more seasoned than he is. He happens to almost stumble into the situation, if we can put it that way. They are in one place and we've got the police in another place, and part of the course of the book is to see how they come together physically, how Victor and his father are going to meet, if indeed they are going to meet. And it's absolutely brilliantly done. And then the Sri Lanka delegate, we hear from him the least probably of any of the characters. But I absolutely loved that because it was a very unexpected turn of events. And we really see the effects of what is happening out on the streets of Seattle. All these thousands and thousands of people sitting in locked formations around intersections, not letting anyone through, and how that actually affects him in these very brief, quite poignant sections as well.
Right. I mean, it's quite interesting that you see inside the sort of conference and obviously the protest outside. Do you find yourself particularly drawn to one bit more than the rest? I mean, is the bit inside the conference kind of more interesting, or do you prefer to be out on the street with the characters?
So we don't see as much inside the conference because this book isn't really about the nitty-gritty of the politics. It's about the politics of the street, I guess, and it's really a book about love and responsibility and protest. So I loved all the stuff that was out on the streets because this was a period of history I didn't really know about. I had no idea there were such massive protests only a few years ago, really. So I was, you know, straight on the internet afterwards looking at pictures of how the protesters were sat, because there's lots of really interesting stuff about all the methods they came up with to ensure that police just would not be able to get through. And so the police had to react in really shocking, awful ways that we're still debating to this day and that are in the news. You know, we're talking a lot about police brutality in America, and this is something that this book really tackles.
I mean, it's interesting because Yapa did do a lot of research before he wrote this book. I mean, how accurately are the real life events kind of told in this book?
I am not an expert on the protests, but I really felt a sense of how fraught they were, how difficult a time both sides had. My sympathy ultimately was for the protesters. I could not see a justification for some of the police actions that take place throughout the novel. So I think Yapa succeeds in taking us to a place and time and through the eyes of a few characters. Really, you know, it's a beautifully written book, but it's also a bit of a punch to the gut as well.
Your Heart is a Muscle, the Size of a Fist by Sunil Yapa is published by Lee Boudreau Books and is out now. Next on our list today is Rush O, another debut novel, this time by Australian writer Shirley Barrett. Set in the early 20th century on the coast of New South Wales, this tells the story of a whaling family and their relationship with a pod of killer whales. Sarah, you'll have to fill us in on the rest of the storyline here.
So this is, I describe it as Moby Dick meets a grown-up Anne of Green Gables. There's perhaps a hint of Jane Austen-style storytelling in this as well. We are told the story through the eyes of Mary Davidson, who is the oldest daughter in a whaling family in a small Australian community. And she tells us of the season of 1908, which was a particularly hard time for this family, where they weren't really catching as many whales as they wanted to. They catch the whales to take the blubber for oil and sell the oil. And it sounds, it's a difficult book to pitch in some ways, but it is one of the funniest books I've ever read. I feel it's such a hard job to make writing funny. And when you can do it successfully, I found myself laughing out loud constantly at this book. But it's also fairly gruesome. There's no details spared when we hear about how whales are caught. And that's a really fascinating part of the book, is that I didn't realise, but there are other types of whales that help catch the whales that this family are after. So they help with the chase and help with cornering the whale in the right place, while the men on boats follow with harpoons.
Right, okay. So that's the scene where we're obviously in the early 20th century. We're in New South Wales. How does the storyline evolve from there? How does it progress?
So the whalers get a new member, a mysterious man named John Beck, who was a man of the cloth and has now decided to become a whaler. And Mary is fascinated by him. It's not only a difficult season in terms of catching whales, it's also her first romance, really. So there's a light romantic element throughout the novel. And we follow as the family almost catch whales, as they successfully catch whales, as bigger ones get away from them. And I don't want to spoil anything, but we follow the romance as well, which has some unexpected elements to
it. Okay, we'll leave it there, I guess. I mean, Shirley Barrett, interestingly, she's best known for her screenwriting, really. Her films have won prizes such as the Camera d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. Does this book kind of feel cinematic? Do you think it's almost written with the scope to be turned into a film at a later date?
It's an interesting question, because there are clearly some very big scenes in there, but we see everything through the eyes of Mary. So in the book, we're looking at things from a clifftop while she watches her father out catching whales. So she is not part of the action herself. Obviously, that could easily be changed for a screenplay. And the book does have some absolutely brilliant illustrations in it by Matt Canning. So it's already a very visual book in terms of both the way that Shirley Barrett writes and describes everything that goes on, the action scenes, the quieter family moments, the funny moments where they're in a hurry to get somewhere, but their horse won't go anywhere without their cow, and their cow is very slow, so they have to, you know, wait for everyone to catch up. And then you've got these great drawings as well, which kind of put out on paper what it is you're seeing. So I think it could easily be turned into a film, but who knows?
Right. I mean, because I understand there was a bit of a bidding war for the story. So it's obviously been pretty popular with publishers.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great book. It's something a bit different. And it's just a very funny read, a very grown-up read, a very strong female character who is vulnerable but also brave as well. She's kind of full of contradictions and just lovely to see it all play out.
Well, it's quite interesting. I wonder how difficult it is to kind of inhabit the voice of someone who really did exist and was, you know, a real life character. I mean, you must have to tread quite carefully as a writer when you're doing that.
Yes, and I know that Shirley Barrett did lots of research. There is, luckily for her, lots of newspaper articles and archives that she was able to plunder for information. We see kind of bits and pieces of stuff inspired by those real life kind of accounts of whales being caught, because whenever a whale was caught, it was a community event. So there are some great scenes of kind of when a whale is spotted, the call goes up around the coastline, and you've got everyone rushing out to look what's happening. You've got people rushing out to get food to throw to the whalers as they, you know, chase this fierce whale around the sea.
Rush O by Shirley Barrett is out now, and it's published by Virago. Finally, we're going to end with The Ballroom by British writer and actress Anna Hope. Here we're thrown into an asylum in the Yorkshire Moors, and it's 1911. Each week, the men and women who are usually kept apart in the institution are brought together in a beautiful ballroom for an evening of dancing. During one such evening, John and Ella meet, and a tale of romance, madness, and sanity unravels. Sarah, is this intended to be a love story, or is it kind of making a wider comment on, I guess, these types of institutions?
I think it's making a much wider comment. I think it's an absolutely fantastic love story, but I also think it's a great discussion on these institutions, which, let's face it, only existed just over 100 years ago. But it's also a discussion about science, about reason, about who gets to decide who has a mental illness and why they get to decide. And there's lots in there about class as well, which I thought was fascinating. But it is so much more than a love story, not to do the love story down, but it is a much bigger novel than that.
Do you think that Anna Hope is what do you think she's saying? Where do you think she stands in that debate about, I guess, yeah, as you say, mental illness?
It's a difficult one. I wouldn't want to speak for Anna. I mean, we follow three characters. We follow John and Ella, who are both admitted to this asylum in Yorkshire, and we follow Charles, who is a doctor there, and he is from a different class to them. He's upper class, and he is possibly suffering from some sort of mental illness himself, but because of his class, he is not treated in the same way. And I think there's a clear comment there with Anna Hope saying, look at how society treated these people. And I think there's not a mocking of Charles, but there's a mocking of the scientific world, perhaps, or a comment on the scientific world at the time that, you know, there's a lot of discussion at the time of sterilising the lower classes so that they did not produce more children. And there's, you know, that's clearly not a solution that any rational person would have put forward today.
Right. So I guess the focal relationship here is between John and Ella, as we discussed. How does that relationship kind of develop and evolve over the course of the novel?
So in the place they are in, they are kept physically apart. So there is a women's ward and there is a men's ward or area. And the women do the domestic work, like the washing and the cleaning, and the men are out on the field. So John and Ella only see each other once a week on a Friday at this ball. They initially see each other on Ella's first full day when she attempts to run away, and then don't see each other for many, many, many weeks afterwards. So it's a very slow burn romance, but it plays out beautifully with the exchange of letters, which I loved, a very, for us, old-fashioned way of doing things. But the power of words is important here, the power of words and the power of imagery. There's a lot about the outside world and nature, which really helps both Ella and John.
Okay. Do we get a kind of sense of their, I guess, the inner workings of their minds, these unstable minds potentially? I mean, how well does Hope delve into these minds?
She delves into it really well, and we find out very quickly why Ella has been admitted. She broke a window, and that's pretty much it. But because of her class, they thought, well, we can say that she is unstable and put her in an institution. John's reasons for being there are very different. But as we get to know them, we realise that they're not unstable. They've just gone through some difficult times and reacted in perfectly normal ways, but society has said, let's put them away.
Right. And in terms of kind of a sense of place, I mean, I guess we're in the Yorkshire Moors. That's quite an amazing scene to set your, and an asylum, no less, there. Do we get a kind of amazing sense of place in this novel?
We get a really good sense of the asylum itself, which is a beautiful, grand old building set in a beautiful bit of land. There's a wood nearby that plays a significant part in throughout the book. There's obviously lots of farms and fields, and like I said, nature plays a big part. John spends a lot of his time farming. Ella wants to spend a lot of time outside, so we do really get a sense of that place. And it is a bit incongruous having a mental institution in the middle of such beautiful countryside, you know, rolling hills and farmland.
Is it told in a kind of a claustrophobic way? I'm kind of imagining, you know, you've got all this amazing space outside, but actually, say, Ella is kind of cooped up inside this asylum.
There is a sense of claustrophobia for Ella, especially because it's a building where she is. The building has lots of windows, but they're very high up and they're very small and they're never really opened. And one of the crucial things about this novel is that it is set during a heat wave. So that's even more oppressive, that... You know, it's the kind of heat wave where as soon as people step outside, they're boiling hot. And this is obviously in the days before air conditioning. So inside in these closed rooms where they're washing mountains and mountains of sheets and running them through mangles, it's a very, you know, there's a contrast between where John gets to be and what he sees and where Ella gets to be and what she sees.
The Ballroom by Anna Hope is out today, published by Transworld. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks very much to my guest, Sarah Shaffy. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. This show was produced by Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow to look ahead to the weekend in cinema. But for now, goodbye from me, and thanks very much for listening.